Welcome back, everyone. We're diving deep today, folks, into a fascinating piece of ancient literature, the Song of Songs. Now, you might know it from the Bible, but we're approaching it a little differently this time around as ancient love poetry. And to help us navigate, well, we have a leading expert,
It's great to be here.
Dr. Lloyd Carr. He's been studying the Song of Songs for quite some time now, and we're going to pick his brain, uncover what makes this book so unique compared to other ancient love poems out there and what kind of surprises it holds.
Because there are a lot.
Oh, I bet. I bet. So before we jump into the Song of Songs itself, I want to kind of get a lay of the land, like how familiar are you with the Song of Songs? Some people think it's an allegory, others say it's a celebration of human love, and today we're going to dive into those different interpretations. But first, what makes it so special?
Well, one of the things that struck me the most, when I first started studying this, most ancient love poems, they're full of, gods and goddesses, fertility rituals, all that stuff.
Makes sense.
The Song of Songs, though, completely secular. No
Really?
mention of the divine, no rituals, just human beings and their experiences, their very human experiences of love.
That's pretty radical, huh? Especially for something that's become part of, a sacred book. So what do you think the authors were trying to do, but focusing solely on that, on human love? What was the message there?
I think, it makes you wonder, were they intentionally, elevating human love, giving it a special place, separate from the divine? Were they saying that human love is valuable, worthy of celebration in and of itself?
Yeah, that's a powerful statement for sure, especially back then. So, I mean, I guess that kind of makes me think about like the world these authors lived in. Religion was so intertwined with every aspect of life, daily life, and yet they chose to create this space where human emotion takes center stage. It's fascinating.
Right. And it's not just that, another way the Song of Songs stands out is the female voice
Oh, yeah.
that's very present.
Yeah, women speak a lot more than men in the Song of Songs. And I heard that's actually kind of a common thread throughout ancient love poetry in different cultures. Why do you think that is? Why give women so much space?
Yeah, it's pretty consistent across cultures. Women, they consistently have twice as many lines as men in love poetry. That's a pattern we see in Mesopotamia, Egypt, you name it. And the Song of Songs, it follows suit.
Wow. Okay, so it's not just a biblical thing. So what do you make of that? I mean, it's so different from what we might expect about ancient societies.
It really suggests that women's voices, their feelings, their desires, they were considered important, at least in the context of romantic love. So even in societies that might have, limited women's roles in other areas of life, love poetry seems to have provided this space for their expression.
It really makes you wonder, huh? Like how did women feel about their place in society? Did they feel empowered through this form of expression? I mean, those are big questions.
Yeah, that's a question for the ages, isn't it? But it's a thought-provoking aspect of the Song of Songs, that's for sure.
Definitely. So before we get too deep into the Song of Songs itself, I think it'd be helpful to kind of step back and understand how ancient poetry worked, because I know it's a little different from what we might be used to, today.
Absolutely. It's not about rhyming every other line. The heart of ancient poetry, it's parallelism.
Okay.
It's like thought rhyming. The second line, it mirrors the first, either by repeating it or contrasting it, or maybe expanding on the idea. And the Song of Songs is full of this. Like when it describes a lover leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills,
Yeah, I mean, those lines, they paint such a vivid picture. I mean, leaping and bounding. But I'm curious, like, how does this technique, this parallelism, impact the reader's experience compared to modern poetry?
Well, think about it. The repetition, it emphasizes those key ideas.
Right.
It creates this sense of buildup, of intensity. And then those contrasts, well, they highlight different aspects of the same thought, prompting you to think more deeply about the meaning.
It's like it's not just about pretty words, it's about using the language to shape the reader's understanding. That's really interesting. Now, I know we're going to get into the actual poetry, but I do want to touch on one more thing Dr. Carr mentioned. This thing called chiastic structure.
Oh yeah.
What is that exactly?
It's kind of like a literary sandwich. The lines, they mirror each other in this cross-shaped pattern. So the first and last parts correspond, the second and last, and so on.
It's like a secret code or something? What's the point of this mirroring?
It's more like a literary tool,
right,
that helps emphasize certain themes. It's a way for the authors to guide your attention, to the central ideas of the poem.
So it's like adding a special emphasis on certain parts. Yeah. Okay. Now, before we dive into the specifics of how that works in the Song of Songs, I think it's important to understand the broader context of love poetry in the ancient world. Were there common themes and elements that kind of popped up across cultures?
Absolutely. Yeah. If we're going to understand the Song of Songs as a piece of love poetry, we need to know what love poetry even meant back then.
Right.
And one of those universal elements, it's the Aitau address.
Okay.
In ancient languages, saying you in the singular form, it implied a very close relationship.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't something you'd use with a stranger.
So when lovers used it, it's like extra special.
Exactly. It underscores that intimacy, that depth of their bond.
Hmm.
And speaking of universal themes, almost every culture's love poetry talks about joy, excitement, the obstacles that lovers face.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely seen that in the Song of Songs. Like, remember where the woman's brothers try to keep her away from her lover? I mean, classic tale, as old as time. But even with those obstacles, it seems like, ancient love poems are always about the triumph of love in the end.
Yeah. Love always finds a way.
Right.
And don't forget, the vivid descriptions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Ancient poets, they love to paint these detailed portraits of their beloveds physically and emotionally.
Oh, yeah. Like in the Song of Songs, where it talks about your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes.
Yeah. I mean, you can practically picture it, right? And that's not all. Dr. Carr mentions this hilarious Egyptian poem where a man, he describes his love as being so strong, he'd swim the Nile, crocodiles and all, just to be with her.
Oh, they weren't holding back on the passion. I guess that's something that transcends time and culture. Is there anything else that kind of stands out as a common thread in ancient love poetry?
One thing that might surprise you is the use of family terms as endearments. Calling your lover, brother or sister, it wasn't necessarily literal. It was a way of expressing a deep, almost familial connection.
It's like it's more about the emotional bond than actual, blood ties.
Right.
Yeah.
It's fascinating how language is used to express different layers of meaning.
Mm.
But now let's get to what really sets the Song of Songs apart.
Okay, yeah.
We talked about all those common elements in ancient love poetry. The Song of Songs, it does something quite surprising.
Okay, now we're getting to the good stuff. I'm all ear.
Right.
So what makes the Song of Songs break the mold?
Remember how most ancient love poetry was closely tied to, fertility rituals and religious beliefs? Well, the Song of Songs avoids that completely.
No way.
No gods and goddesses, no rituals.
Wow. So in the entire book, there's not a single mention of God.
That's right. It's a radical departure from the norm. Dr. Carr, he even says he was astounded to find absolutely no religious words in the entire Song of Songs.
I mean, that makes you think, right? Which why deliberately leave out something that was so central to their culture?
Exactly. It really raises questions about the author's intentions.
Yeah.
And how they viewed human love in relation to the divine.
I'm starting to see why the Song of Songs is considered so unique. So it's secular, it gives women prominent voices, it doesn't shy away from vivid, descriptions. What else sets it apart?
Well, another interesting omission is the lack of hunting imagery. It's common in other love poetry to use hunting metaphors,
uh-huh,
to describe the pursuit of love, but the Song of Songs, it avoids that completely.
Oh, wow. So no comparing a lover to a captured gazelle or anything like that.
Nope, not at all. Dr. Carr suggests this might be connected to the respect for life that was characteristic of ancient Israel.
It's like they were trying to portray love as something beautiful and life-giving, not something that involves, conquest or domination.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And this leads to another key distinction. While many cultures, they saw nature as an extension of the divine, the Song of Songs makes a very clear distinction
Okay.
between God and nature. So nature is God's creation, but it's not God itself.
Right. So they're drawing a line saying that human love and the natural world are separate from the divine.
Exactly.
Okay.
And this further emphasizes the uniqueness and the importance of human love as something distinct and special.
Okay, so we've established that the Song of Songs is unique in some pretty significant ways. It's secular, it celebrates life, it focuses on the beauty of human love. But Dr. Carr also mentioned some challenges when it comes to interpreting this book. What are some of the hurdles we might encounter?
Well, one of the biggest hurdles is the vocabulary. The Song of Songs, it has a very unique vocabulary. In fact, 10% of the words in the entire book appear nowhere else in the Bible.
Wow.
And many, many others are incredibly rare, making it really difficult to know their precise meanings.
So we're dealing with a text that's both beautiful and a bit mysterious.
It's like we're trying to solve a puzzle with some of the pieces missing.
Right, exactly.
It's definitely a challenge. But it also adds to the intrigue.
Yeah.
You know, it forces us to think critically about the text. And consider multiple interpretations.
Yeah, I'm up for the challenge.
Okay.
And speaking of multiple interpretations, Dr. Carr mentioned this concept of double entendre.
Uh-huh.
Can you explain what those are and how they play into the Song of Songs?
Sure. Double entendre, they're words or phrases that have, you know, two meanings, one literal and one, you know, often more suggestive or risque. And the Song of Songs is full of them.
Okay, so can you give me like an actual example? How does a double entendre work in the Song of Songs?
Okay, take the Hebrew word for to know. Now, it can mean, you know, to understand something intellectually.
Right.
But it can also refer to sexual intimacy. So when the text says, you know, and Adam knew Eve, it's a double entendre.
Okay.
Referring to both knowledge and physical union.
Wow, that adds a whole new layer of meaning to the text. Right. So we have to really pay attention to the context, I guess, to figure out what the author's intended.
Yeah.
And speaking of words with multiple meanings, what about the word for love itself?
That's another tricky one.
Yeah.
Unlike Greek, which has, you know, multiple words for love, Hebrew, it only has one, ahav.
How do we know what kind of love they're talking about in the Song of Songs?
That's where we need to, you know, put on our detective hats. Examine the surrounding words, the imagery, the overall message to determine the specific shade of meaning in each passage. You know, is it passionate love, familial love, self-love? Who knows?
This is definitely going to be a deep dive in every sense of the word.
It definitely is.
Right.
But that's what makes it so fascinating.
Well, we've uncovered a lot in this first part of our deep dive. We've talked about the Song of Songs, you know, unique features, its poetic techniques, and those tantalizing double entendres. But we've only just scratched the surface.
There's so much more.
So in the next part, we'll delve even deeper into the structure and meaning of this remarkable piece of ancient love poetry. So stay tuned.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the Song of Songs. You know, we've established that it's this unique piece of ancient love poetry.
Yeah.
But how do we actually make sense of it? Like how is it structured? You know, it doesn't really read like a typical story.
You're telling me I've tried reading it through before and it feels more like a whirlwind of emotions and imagery than a straightforward narrative. Okay. So how do we make sense of all the different parts and how they fit together?
Well, that's where understanding the structure becomes crucial.
Okay.
And luckily Dr. Carr offers, you know, some great insights.
Yeah.
One key element he highlights is that chiastic structure we touched on earlier.
Right, the literary sandwich where the beginning and end they mirror each other.
Yeah.
But how does that actually work in the Song of Songs? I'm still a little fuzzy on that.
Okay, so it's more like a series of nested sandwiches.
Oh, okay.
If you have these smaller parallel sections within larger parallel sections,
uh-huh,
all pointing towards a central theme.
Okay, so it's more complex than just the first and last lines match up.
Right.
So can you give me like a concrete example of how this chiastic structure plays out in the Song of Songs?
Absolutely. So let's look at chapters 4 and 5.
Okay.
And in chapter 4, the man, he describes the woman's beauty.
Right.
In great detail. And then he invites her into his garden.
Mm-hmm.
Then in chapter 5, the text shifts to the consummation of their wife.
Right, right. The part where he talks about eating his honey cone with his honey and drinking his wine with his milk. I mean, pretty steamy.
It is. And notice how the poem then continues in reverse order.
Okay.
The woman seeks her lover, just as he had sought her earlier.
Right.
We see echoes of the garden imagery and the descriptions of their beauty.
So the chaotic structure isn't just some random, you know, literary device.
Right.
It actually helps to emphasize the central themes of the poem and create this sense of completion.
Exactly. The chiastic structure in this case, it highlights the reciprocity of their desire and the way their love builds upon itself.
Hmm. That's really interesting. It's like the poem is telling us that their love is a journey with a clear destination, that moment of intimate union.
Right. And the chiastic structure reinforces that journey by bringing us back to the starting point,
mm-hmm.
but with a deeper understanding of their love.
Okay. So chiastic structure is one important piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
What other structural elements should we be looking for?
Another key element is repetition.
Okay.
Throughout the Song of Songs, you'll find certain phrases, images, even entire scenes repeated sometimes with slight variations.
I've definitely noticed that like the constant references to garden spices and doves.
Yeah.
It's almost like a song with a recurring chorus.
That's a great analogy, and just like a chorus in a song.
Right.
It emphasizes certain, you know, emotions or ideas.
Uh-huh.
The repetition in the Song of Songs, it highlights those key themes and invites us to pay, you know, closer attention to their meaning.
So it's not just about, you know, sounding nice. It's about driving home certain points.
Right. For example, the frequent descriptions of the lover's beauty,
yeah,
they're not just there to be aesthetically pleasing. They reinforce the idea that physical attraction plays a vital role in their love.
Okay. So the repetition helps us understand that the physical and sensual aspects of their relationship are important.
Exactly. And the repetition also creates a sense of rhythm and flow,
mm.
almost like a dance between the two lovers.
It makes me think of those romantic scenes in old movies where couples are dancing, you know, and gazing into each other's eyes.
Yes, it captures that sense of being, you know, completely engrossed in the moment, lost in the beauty and the intensity of love.
Okay, so we've got chiastic structure and repetition. What else makes up the framework of the Song of Songs?
Well, the Song of Songs, it's ultimately a conversation.
Okay.
It's a dialogue between the two lovers.
Right.
It's a back and forth expression of their desires, their longings, their joys.
And it's not always, you know, perfectly smooth sailing, is it? There are interruptions, moments of confusion, even arguments.
Right.
Just like in real relationships.
Exactly. It's not a fairy tale.
Right.
It's a raw, honest portrayal of love with all its ups and downs.
Yeah.
And just like in any good conversation, there are shifts in tone, changes in topic, even moments of silence.
It's like we're eavesdropping on a real couple experiencing their love story firsthand.
Yeah.
And that rawness, you know, makes it even more relatable.
Right.
I know I've definitely had, you know, moments of miscommunication or frustration in my own relationships.
And that's the beauty of the Song of Songs.
Yeah.
You know, it speaks to the universal experience of love with all its complexities and contradictions.
So you mentioned that the Song of Songs is structured as a dialogue. So does that mean that the speakers are always clearly identified?
Well, that's actually one of the challenges of interpreting this poem.
Right.
Sometimes it's clear who's speaking, but other times it's left ambiguous.
Mm.
You know, it's up to the reader to kind of decipher who's saying what.
So it's like a literary puzzle where we have to like piece together the different voices and perspectives.
Exactly. But even when the speaker isn't explicitly identified, we often get, you know, clues from the content and the tone of the language.
Okay, so we have to really pay attention to the nuances of the text to figure out like who's talking, what are some of the things we should be listening for.
Well, one thing to notice is the use of direct address.
Okay.
The lovers are constantly speaking to each other.
Right.
Using those intimate I-vowel pronouns that we talked about earlier.
Right. That special way of saying you that signifies a close relationship.
Exactly. And they often use terms of endearment, like, you know, my love, my dove, my sister, my bride.
Okay, so that's a good clue. If we see those intimate pronouns and loving terms, it's likely that one lover is speaking directly to the other.
Precisely. And this direct address, it creates a sense of immediacy.
Right.
And intimacy.
Yeah.
It draws the reader into their private world.
Like we're right there with them, witnessing their love unfold. And speaking of witnessing, I'm curious about the role of the chorus in the Song of Songs.
The chorus, that's another fascinating element.
Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like there's a group of people commenting on the action, you know, offering their perspectives on the lovers and their relationship.
So it's not just a two-person show.
Right.
There are other voices kind of chiming in,
yeah,
adding their own layers of interpretation.
Exactly. It's like having a Greek chorus in a play.
Right.
Offering commentary.
Yeah.
And enriching the overall experience.
It makes me think about how love is often a public affair, even if it's, you know, experienced privately.
Yeah.
Our friends and families, they witness our relationships. They offer advice. They celebrate with us. They console us.
Yeah.
The chorus in the Song of Songs seems to represent that communal aspect of love.
That's a beautiful insight. And it reminds us that love isn't just about two individuals.
Right.
It's also about the community that surrounds them.
Okay, so we've talked about chiastic structure, repetition, dialogue, and the chorus. Are there any other structural elements that we should be aware of?
One more element that Dr. Carr points out is the use of imagery drawn from nature.
Oh yeah.
The Song of Songs. It's overflowing with references to flowers, trees, animals, scents, landscapes, you name it.
Oh yeah. I've noticed that it's almost like a sensory overload.
Right.
In a good way, you can practically smell the spices and feel the sun on your skin.
Yeah.
But what's the purpose of all this natural imagery? Is it just there for, you know, decoration?
It's much more than decoration.
Okay.
These images, they act as symbols,
uh-huh,
adding layers of meaning and emotion to the poem.
So it's like nature becomes a language of love.
Exactly. For example, the woman's hair.
Yeah.
It's compared to a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead.
Right.
Now, it's not meant to be taken literally.
Right.
It's a way of expressing her beauty and abundance.
So the imagery is a way of expressing things that might be difficult to put into words directly.
Precisely. And by using, you know, images from nature,
yeah,
the Song of Songs connects human love to the natural world, suggesting that love is a fundamental part of creation.
It reminds me of how people often give, you know, flowers as a symbol of love.
Yeah.
They're a way of expressing something that words can't always, you know, capture.
That's a perfect example. And the natural imagery also reinforces the poem's, you know, celebration of life and fertility.
Right.
Remember the Songs of Songs, it's a Stephaner poem.
Yeah.
But it still affirms the goodness of creation and the power of love to bring forth new life.
It's like the poem is telling us to appreciate the beauty of the world around us,
yeah,
and to see love as an integral part of that beauty.
Exactly. And this appreciation for nature,
yeah,
for the senses, for the beauty of the human body,
yeah,
it's all tied into that playful and sensual tone of the Song of Songs. You know, it's not afraid to be explicit.
Right. It embraces the erotic, the physical aspects of love in a way that's both, you know, beautiful and a little bit shocking. I mean, you don't usually find that kind of language in religious texts.
It definitely pushes boundaries.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so, you know, so revolutionary.
Yeah.
It suggests that intimacy is something to be celebrated, not hidden away.
Okay. So we've explored the structure of the Song of Songs in quite a bit of detail. We've talked about, you know, chiastic structure, repetition, dialogue, the chorus, and natural imagery, But what does this all mean? What's the takeaway for us as modern readers?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what we'll delve into in the final part of our deep dive. We'll uncover the hidden meanings and explore the enduring power of the Song of Songs. So stay tuned.
And we're back for the final part of our deep dive into the Song of Songs. We've gone through a lot, haven't we? We've explored those unique features, the poetic structure, all those tantalizing double entendres, but now let's get to the heart of it, you know? Like, what does it all mean? What can we learn from this ancient love poem, you know, thousands of years later?
It's the question that keeps, you know, scholars and readers coming back to the Song of Songs again and again.
Right.
You know, it doesn't offer easy answers, but it invites us to explore the complexities of love, its joys, its struggles, its enduring power.
Yeah, and one thing that really struck me is that the Song of Songs is completely secular.
Right.
No God, no religious rituals, just pure, unadulterated human love.
Yeah.
So why do you think the authors chose to focus solely on human experience?
It's a bold choice, especially considering the religious context of the ancient world.
Right.
And by, you know, excluding the divine, the Song of Songs, it elevates human love to a place of prime importance.
Right.
It suggests that love isn't just about, you know, fulfilling religious duties or societal expectations.
Right.
It's something valuable and meaningful in its own right.
So maybe they were saying that human love is this powerful force that deserves to be, you know, celebrated and explored for its own sake, not just for its connection to something, you know, bigger.
Exactly. And in a world where religion often dictated how people should, you know, live and love, the Song of Songs, it offers a different perspective.
Right.
It suggests that human emotions, desires, and experiences, they're worthy of attention and exploration.
And it's not just about love in general. The Song of Songs also celebrates the female voice in a way that's pretty remarkable, I think, for its time. You know, women, they have more lines, they initiate conversations, they express their desires openly. So what does that tell us about the author's views on women and relationships?
It's a fascinating aspect of the poem. Remember how we talked about how women consistently have, you know, more lines in love poetry across cultures? Well, the Song of Songs, it pushes that even further.
Yeah.
You know, the woman's voice is central to the narrative.
Yeah, it's like they're saying, hey, women's experiences and perspectives matter. They're not secondary to men's.
Right. It suggests a level of equality and respect. That's mm-hmm. that's not always reflected in other ancient texts.
Right.
And it challenges us to consider how, you know, societal norms and expectations, how they shape our understanding of love and relationship.
Yeah, it makes me think about how often women's voices are silenced or marginalized even today.
Right.
You know, the Song of Songs seems to be, you know, pushing back against that, advocating for women's right to express themselves freely and authentically.
Absolutely. And this emphasis on the female voice.
Yeah.
It adds another layer of richness to the poem.
Right.
You know, it gives us this glimpse into the inner world
mm-hmm.
of a woman in love, her desires, her fears, her joys.
Speaking of desires, let's talk about the elephant in the room.
Okay.
A Song of Songs is incredibly sensual. It doesn't shy away from describing physical intimacy in pretty explicit detail.
It's true.
So how do we reconcile that with our modern sensibilities, especially if we're, you know, approaching this as a religious text?
It's definitely a challenging aspect of the poem for some readers, but it also forces us to confront our own attitudes
right.
towards sexuality.
Yeah.
Why is it that we often feel, you know, uncomfortable with open expressions of desire and pleasure, especially within, you know, a religious context?
You're right. It makes you think about, like, why we tend to separate the spiritual from the physical. The Song of Songs seems to, you know, embrace the idea that these aspects of human experience are intertwined, that physical intimacy can be a beautiful and sacred part of love.
Exactly. And remember those double entendres we talked about.
Yeah.
The way words can have both a literal and a more, you know, suggestive meaning.
Right.
That playfulness with language, it adds another layer of complexity.
Right.
To the poem's, you know, treatment of sexuality.
Yeah, it's like they're inviting us to see beyond the surface, to recognize that intimacy is multifaceted and can be experienced on different levels.
Precisely. It's not just about the physical act, it's about the emotional and spiritual connection that comes with it.
Okay, but for all its beauty and passion, the Song of Songs can also be pretty confusing.
It can be.
You know, Dr. Carr talked about how challenging it is to interpret those, you know, rare and unique vocabulary choices.
It's true.
It's like trying to decipher a secret code.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what makes the Song of Songs so enduring. You know, it doesn't give us easy answers or neatly packaged interpretations. It invites us to wrestle with the text, to explore different possibilities and to arrive at our own understanding.
It's like the poem is a conversation starter.
Yeah.
Inviting us to engage with it on a personal level and find our own meaning within it.
Exactly. And this conversation isn't just about, you know, understanding the past. It's about illuminating our present.
Yeah.
The Song of Songs, with its timeless themes of love and longing and intimacy, it continues to speak to us today.
Yeah, it's a reminder that no matter how much time passes the human experience of love, it remains this powerful and mysterious force.
And in a world that often feels, you know, divided and fragmented, the Song of Songs offers a message of hope and connection.
Right.
It reminds us that we're all capable of experiencing love.
Yeah.
And its fullest and most profound forms.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I'm left with this sense of awe and wonder. The Song of Songs is a gift, a treasure trove of beauty and wisdom and inspiration.
And it's a gift that keeps on giving.
It does.
Each time we return to it, we discover new layers of meaning, new insights into ourselves and new reasons to celebrate the power of love.
Absolutely. To our listeners, I encourage you to explore the Song of Songs for yourselves. Let its poetry wash over you. Let its passion ignite your soul, and let its wisdom guide you on your own journey of love and discovery.
And as you remember this, the Song of Songs, it's not just an ancient text. It's a living, breathing testament to the enduring power of human connection.
Yeah.
Its message is as relevant today as it was, you know, thousands of years ago.
So go forth, dear listeners, and embrace the beauty of love and all its messy, magnificent glory. I take up